dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for, well, I think of it as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the people who has understood, I think, extraordinarily well, the nature of the war for the free world, because she's seen it up close and personally from her vantage point as an award-winning journalist in Canada, is Christine Douglas Williams. She is an extraordinary, well, analyst and monitor of cultural as well as sociological and national security related developments, notably from her vantage point these days as part of the wonderful Jihad Watch team, Robert Spencer's operation, and as an editor of Front Page magazine. She's also the author, I'm very proud to say, of The Challenge of Modernizing Islam, a very important book published in 2017. She has formerly been with the Canadian Race Relations Foundation as one of its directors. We're always delighted to have her with us. Thank you so much for joining us, Christine. Good to have you back on. Listen, Christine, you've written recently at Jihad Watch about a very malevolent force, I believe, in the United Kingdom at the moment. And his name is Sadiq Khan. And I wanted to kind of invite you to tell us a bit about what he's up to by calling attention to something that is part now of his modus operandi that we're seeing a lot of in this country as well, as you know, namely the toppling of statues that don't seem to suit certain people. Tell us what Sadiq Khan is doing in that regard and more generally that is really ominous.
Frank, Sadiq Khan, from the time he was elected as mayor, this guy just took up the mantle to advertise that he's Muslim, and so did the media. Nothing is wrong with being proud of one's heritage, but this man played his identity politics like a fiddle. Recently, what came to the forefront was because of these Black Lives Matter folks that are demonstrating, tearing down statues like you indicated. He actually went so far as to announce a review. Imagine that, of all London statues and street names, saying that any of them that have any links to slavery should be taken down. But what I find really peculiar about this is that this Sadiq Khan, he's never, of course, eager to even mention the issue of current-day slavery of blacks that's going on in Algeria, Libya, Sudan, Mauritania. He doesn't seem to care about those people, doesn't seem to care or have any interest in the evolution of Western countries in the realms of human rights.
To say nothing of who is perpetrating that slavery.
Yes.
Which would be, just to put a fine point on it, typically Muslims, is it not?
That, yes, it is. Yes, it definitely is. Arab racism, in fact, against blacks is just through the roof. And this is very disturbing to me because what drives what I do is human rights. But this is not something that's discussed. It's just swept under the carpet deliberately by certain Islamist forces that we see. Even the statue of Winston Churchill may have to be put in a museum to protect it. And this is coming from the granddaughter because things are so bad there. I mean, recently something came up with Sadiq Khan, and you know, when I saw it in the paper, I wondered what's going on with him because he comes out and he admits to improper leadership. He did this near the end of June, and he blamed it on poor mental health during the coronavirus lockdown. But nice try, because this guy's incompetence and his dance with identity politics was right from the start when he first became mayor. In fact, when you look at the kind of stuff this man did, and this was as soon as he became mayor, pretty much, he started interfering in U.S. business. He started attacking the ban on Muslim, the temporary ban on Islamic immigration from Muslim countries, even though the countries of concern were chosen by Obama. Days after he became mayor, he went and called Trump's views on Muslims ignorant and stated Donald Trump's ignorant view of Islam could make the country, both countries, less safe. And even when New York City had a jihad bomb explosion, he came right out and said that it's part and parcel of life in the big city. Buddying again to Donald Trump when he wanted to say, we have to get tough on jihad, that was the reaction of Khan, to which Trump has called him a stone-cold loser. But something even bigger has happened recently, because he recently met with police, even with the crisis going on in London, and because the police force in London is hiring something called racism spotters to examine whether prospective police officers are prejudiced. And this is something that Khan is right on board with, and he's actually prepared to slash the budget of the actual police. So crime will rise even higher in London, which is a crisis, because under his leadership, jihad gangs have proliferated in London, acid attacks, knife attacks. 3 years after he became mayor, knife epidemic was so high in London that there was over 51 murders in a space of 6 months. And the London gangs that we see include the Molly Boys. They're organized, they're ruthless, and they're driven by drug profits.
These are immigrants from Somalia, I take it, and they're acting as gangs, sort of with a jihadist dimension to it as well?
That, yes, it does. And as you mention Somalia and what's going on the country, these parents are now sending back their children to Somalia, where gang war is also crazy. They're sending them back there because some of them are finding it, well, you're safer there than the knife crime that's going on here. I mean, talking about what's happening in terms of jihad, an Islamic State jihadist, because it's all intermingled now, tried to create a jihadist child army in East London. And because of what's going on in the jihadist front, the Somalian parents, in addition, said, you know what, it's bad there too. And it makes one wonder, well, why would parents want to send their children back to Somalia when you consider how bad it is there? But that should make you wonder. It says a lot about what's going on in London.
Let me come back to the racism spotters, because if the practice in this country by those like the Council on American Islamic Relations and the Southern Poverty Law Center, its ally on the radical left, if that practice is any guide, what you'll have is basically people who are very prone to see no evil on the part of, these jihadists, among others, being the arbiters of which police may no longer be allowed to serve simply because they're considered not to be with the program. Is that what you expect to happen there?
Yes, this whole victimology narrative is extremely important, and people have actually lost sight of how these Islamist organizations have proliferated and created a fertile ground for Black Lives Matter to penetrate the system and move right along with this historic victimology. When one looks at the Muslim Brotherhood, that has been a strategy for an awfully long time, to the point where Western civilization has become so horrified to be called racist, to be called Islamophobic. They have been scared into a corner. So now that you have this group coming out and saying, we're victimized, and we know the Marxist history, in fact, the Marxist foundation of Black Lives Matter, but they're taking advantage of regular society people that have no idea what the players are behind this stoking violence, stoking anarchy behind this movement.
We have to leave it at that, Christine. We are hard out of time, but this is a subject to which we will return with you soon, I hope, as well as the connections between Iran and Venezuela, which are ominous as well. Let's do that soon. Christine, thank you so much for your time today. I know you'll keep up the great work at Jihad Watch and Front Page Magazine. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, Gordon Chang. We'll talk with him about China and Hong Kong and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, I'm pleased to say, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by one of the country's great authorities on, Asia in general, but the Chinese Communist Party and the country it misrules in particular. His name, of course, is Gordon Chang. He is the author of three terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and Losing South Korea. Gordon is a, extraordinary contributor to the public policy debate, and you should follow him wherever he goes with it, at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. Gordon, it's good to have you in the house virtually. Welcome back. I want to talk about Hong Kong, Gordon. I know you're following this very closely. You've lived there for a time. You've been one of its great champions in terms of the Chinese Communist Party's efforts to break the spirit of the people of Hong Kong and impose the sort of tyranny that is the lot in life of everybody else in China on those people. Give us current reading, if you would, Gordon. We're now several days into the new order of things with this national security law. What's it looking like at the moment, and how are the people of Hong Kong responding to it?
The national security law has been used against 10 protesters who were involved in street demonstrations on July 1st. July 1st is an important date because it marks the handover of Hong Kong from Britain to the People's Republic, and it always has a pro-democracy protest on that date, a march. This year, for the first time since 1997, the year of the handover, there was no permitted July 1st march. So people took to the streets anyway. There were 370 people who were arrested. 10 of those arrested were charged under the national security law. And the first person who was arrested appears to be incommunicado. It looks like they are not going to bring him to any sort of trial until October, which was just announced a few hours ago. That is indeed very worrying. This person could end up in China and tried there because the national security law permits that. Matter of fact, the national security law permits almost anything. And really what it is an attempt to shut down any sort of dissenting voices in Hong Kong and to exert complete control.
I was just hearing a member of the executive committee in Hong Kong, obviously very much aligned with the Chinese Communist Party, on the BBC a moment ago, trying to make it sound as though really there's no reason for concern about this. Of course, people will be tried in Hong Kong by magistrates in Hong Kong. But Gordon, what do we know about the people that Carrie Lam, the chief executive of Hong Kong, has announced are going to be adjudicating matters, if indeed it's going to be done in Hong Kong? Are these indeed people that one can anticipate will permit the rule of law that was one of the hallmarks of one country, two systems to continue to operate?
Yeah, I don't think we know yet how the 360 people are going to be tried. And this is, of course, important because there have been suggestions that the national security law will be used. It will be applied so that there'll be special courts. This is really yet to be determined. And so everyone is watching this. And of course, right now, there is a concerted propaganda campaign, both in Hong Kong and in Beijing, to try to convince the world that this law is targeted only against a few individuals. But of course, it does have very broad effect. And indeed, many people think that the reason why the law was hurried into enactment was really to try to make sure that the pro-democracy forces didn't win in the September LegCo elections. That's the Legislative Council, which is essentially the legislature for Hong Kong. And so there really is an attempt to shut down the democratic process through this national security law.
Speaking of Beijing, there was a prominent, I guess you'd call him dissident, professor by the name of Xu Jianrong, who has been taken into custody by the authorities in the mainland. Is there a likelihood that this is a further signal to those who still hold out any hope for freedom in Hong Kong that that's a hope that will be dashed by the CCP?
Xu was picked up a few hours ago, and they went to extraordinary effort to do this. They brought in 10 police cars, 20 policemen to pick up one professor. He is prominent. Xu is prominent in China for being a critic of Xi Jinping, and he's been outspoken over the last couple months. And obviously, his being picked up signals that Xi Jinping is actually stronger than he was perhaps a few months ago when Xu was allowed to speak openly. So, of course, this does indicate a new crackdown, and we probably, as some people suggest, will see a concerted roundup of voices in China in the next few weeks or so. And of course, this comes at the same time as, Hong Kong is now under the national security law. So this does seem to be an even darker China than it was before.
Gordon, that brings us to what should we be doing about it? And as we've talked about before, and I know you are keenly aware, there is an opportunity at the moment to act both in a manner that's entirely, I believe, required by our national security, certainly justified by it, but also that would be a very, I think, meaningful response to what China is now doing to Hong Kong, in Hong Kong, and to others, perhaps elsewhere, as you say, in China, who want to be part of the free world and not enslaved by the Chinese Communist Party. And that is this, well, windfall, I guess you might say, that came about as a result of the Pentagon recently making clear that there are more than 20 companies that are described as communist Chinese military companies, that is to say, tied to the People's Liberation Army, that are doing business in the United States. Gordon, knowing what you do about both the PLA particularly, but more generally, what Chinese companies and nationals are obliged to do in places like the United States pursuant to the so-called National Intelligence Law of China, what kind of business are these outfits likely doing here?
Well, to refer to the 2017 National Intelligence Law, that requires every Chinese entity and every Chinese individual to spy if demanded. And of course, PLA companies don't even need a formal demand to do that. And this raises a whole issue of reciprocity, because we have an open economy, an open society. We allow China to operate here in ways that we could not operate in China. So it's important to demand reciprocity, which in effect means turfing out Chinese companies, Chinese apps, all sorts of things where Beijing is operating here. The other thing, Frank, you know, in terms of Hong Kong, which is important, is this Hong Kong Autonomy Act, which passed both houses of Congress last week unanimously, now is sent to President Trump for his signature. The president has not indicated whether he'll sign it or not, but I suspect he will. This act has Magnitsky-type sanctions on individuals, and those aren't going to have very much effect. And these would apply to individuals who erode Hong Kong's autonomy. What is important in this bill is that it does permit Chinese, it does permit the U.S. To deny to Chinese banks that deal with sanctioned individuals that we can actually unplug them from their dollar accounts. This would be effective not only in terms of Hong Kong, but also in terms of shaking China. And this is one way we can actually go and do something effective, because if we were to unplug these Chinese banks, it would be the end of those banks, the end of the Chinese banking system, perhaps the end of China's financial system, the end of the Chinese economy, maybe even the end of Communist Party rule. So we have the tools to act. We just haven't used them, which means this is an issue of political will.
It is, and I think this is a moment when that will needs to be expressed. As I recall, those pieces of legislation were overwhelmingly adopted, if not unanimously, darn near, and that presumably would be a consideration for the president that a veto, if he were actually to think of one, will not be sustained.
Yes, they were unanimous, both houses of Congress, and they do have veto-proof majorities.
Yeah. So these are two ways in which the president could very usefully demonstrate both resolve vis-a-vis China and perhaps impose extremely high costs. Policy banks in particular are ones that we've had our eye on at the Committee on the Present Danger of China, as you know, Gordon. But getting at them, getting at the banking system of China more generally, as well as these People's Liberation Army companies, seems to me to make eminent sense. Gordon, there's one other thing that I just want to touch on with you. We won't have time to get into it in detail, but you've studied closely the Chinese Communist Party over the years, of course. You've understood intimately, you know, the Maoist doctrine and strategy for engaging in things like People's War, which was actually declared against the United States by the Chinese Communist Party last year, as I recall. When you look at what's happening in the streets of America at the hands of self-avowed Marxists, some of whom our friend Trevor Loudon has directly tied to the Chinese Communist Party through organizations like Freedom Road, Socialist Organization, Liberation Road, is it any surprise that we'd see this kind of, well, revolutionary activity is the way I think of it, in keeping with kind of people's war and mass line movements and the like that the Chinese Communist Party has long favored?
We shouldn't be surprised at all, Frank. The Global Times, which is a Communist Party tabloid, and the Foreign Ministry have openly engaged in a disinformation campaign against the United States in connection with all of the recent protests. And much of this has been just blatantly false information. I mean, it's just so obvious. Also, you know, there are other hints that China has actually been involved directly in the protests. Those in Washington, D.C., a number of people have been overheard talking about their relationship with China, and they're doing this for China as they were engaged in riots. But also, we have seen some other disturbing activity. So, for instance, at the end of January, U.S. Customs and Border Protection seized $1 bills that were counterfeited in China in Minnesota at a port of entry. Nobody counterfeits $1 bills for profit. Also, we know that these bills counterfeited in China, no one can engage in such an extensive operation without the knowledge of the Communist Party. So we've got to be very concerned that this was an operation intended to fuel protesters in the United States.
Gordon Chang, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time today, as well as the great work you do in literally every media outlet I can think of, as well as, of course, through your writings and your tweeting at Gordon G. Chang. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again next week, if you would. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry joins us. We'll talk about another piece of the China threat, its nuclear one. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by one of my favorite national security practitioners. His name is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He has contributed over, well, decades of public service, initially with the Central Intelligence Agency, subsequently with a number of committees in the House of Representatives, and then several of the special commissions that Congress saw fit to establish, including most, perhaps importantly, the Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse, or EMP, Threat Commission. Peter Pry has written extensively about such issues, including several we'll be talking with him about today, notably Communist China's activities with respect to nuclear warfighting and the capabilities to engage in such warfighting, both through the use of those weapons in the normal way, that is to say, kinetically, to cause mass devastation through blast and fireballs and shockwaves and the like, but also through another asymmetric means, which Peter again is deeply expert in, namely electromagnetic pulse. This is in fact the subject of a paper that he wrote recently as part of his National Security and Homeland Security Task Force. It's entitled China's Pearl Harbor Plans. I'm very pleased to say you can read all about it at securethegrid.com, among other places. Peter Pry, it's so good to have you back. Thank you for taking a few minutes to join us today. Peter, you have, in this piece, raised an alarm, but before we get to that, I want to talk about, more generally, what we know about the Chinese Communist Party's plans for nuclear warfare, their doctrine, and their increasing, as I say, their increasing capabilities for engaging in it.
Well, we, in the Washington establishment and academia, unfortunately, doesn't know much, because the China, like every totalitarian nation, tries to protect its war plans behind a bodyguard of lies. And the Chinese have put out a lot of misinformation over the decades, particularly on the idea that they have a no-first-use doctrine. And this has served as a comfort, a security blanket for Washington and for academics for many years to not worry about China's nuclear arsenal, you know, because they believe and have taken advantage of value for the most part. There's no first-use pledge from China. And I think that that's disinformation. You know, we had a similar experience with the Soviet Union during the Cold War when they had a no-first-use pledge that was out there that a lot of Western academics and people on the left, but a lot of serious people, too, that, you know, thought that took it at face value that the Soviet Union maybe really had a no-first-use pledge that they were serious about. I think, again, there it was also wishful thinking, you know, people not wanting to face up to the reality that this was disinformation. And we now know in the aftermath of the Cold War, when we had insight into the Warsaw Pact nuclear archives, that it was, in fact, disinformation from the USSR. And what they planned was just the opposite. And I think that that's a pretty good rule of thumb to follow when you're dealing with authoritarian and totalitarian states, that they're usually planning to do just the opposite of what they're planning, of what they're promising.
And this has the very negative effect on our preparedness as a result, does it not? Whether it's because of the wishful thinking or whether it's just because it's too horrifying to contemplate, Peter Pry, we tend to default to the idea that, well, if they say they're not going to do that to us, we can take that to the bank. Which brings us, Peter, you know, beyond the prospect of actual, you know, nuclear war fighting by a Chinese Communist Party that is increasingly armed with weapons, many of them hidden in 3,000 miles of tunnels that would devastate this country. But there's also this other piece that I'm anxious to have you tell us about. We talk about it each time you're on the program, of course, but talk about it specifically in terms of what we understand of Chinese, well, unrestricted warfare techniques, as it's been called, that might result in the use of an electromagnetic pulse attack against this country.
Yeah, that was the focus of my report on the EMP threat. And people don't have to take my word for it, because I provide extensive quotations from China's military doctrine and technical and scientific papers that they don't think the West is going to pay that much attention to, as opposed to their overt official rhetoric that the West does pay attention to. And if you look at what the China is talking about among itself and among its own experts, they have been planning for an EMP attack against the United States for more than a quarter century. And this involves, you know, the use of a nuclear weapon detonated at high altitude outside of space. You had referred to kinetic nuclear attacks before that produce fireballs and radiation and fallout and that sort of thing. Well, an EMP attack doesn't produce any of those things. It just produces electromagnetic pulse. It can fry electronics across a vast area, potentially across all of North America, and bring a society to its knees and potentially win a nuclear war with just one weapon, just with that. And then there are non-nuclear EMP weapons, too, that China has been writing about and has in its inventory, and it is also prepared to use in war. And one of the aspects of the no first use myth, you know, is EMP, because China, in its official doctrine, doesn't consider an EMP attack, even if it's done by a nuclear weapon, to be crossing the threshold into nuclear war. They consider this in the province of electronic warfare or information warfare or cyber warfare, a gray zone kind of a threat. And indeed, we actually are standing in the middle of a potential crisis with China right now, because in March there was a panel of Chinese military experts who said, well, what could we do to deal with the U.S. constantly challenging our illegal annexation of the South China Sea by sending Navy ships in to show the flag in the South China Sea? And one of their solutions was, well, let's do an EMP attack on a Navy ship that does that. It's short of all-out war, because it will damage the ship, so it'll be inoperable, but the crew will be alive. So they made that threat in March 2020, and now we have two aircraft carriers. It'll be the biggest flag-showing exercise we've ever had, getting ready to go into the South China Sea. And what will happen? It's possible that such a thing could happen. I'm not saying it's likely, but such a thing could happen. They've written about it in their doctrine. They threatened us. And, of course, something like that could escalate to an attack on our homeland. So while we're focused with violence on our own streets and the societal chaos that's going on now, we've got a development like this happening in the Pacific, you know, that could pose a threat to our whole society. And who knows? They might even be tempted by the chaos in our streets, because we look a lot like 1968 right now, you know, when America psychologically lost the Vietnam War, and they might be tempted to aggression.
As I was just discussing with Gordon Chang, Peter Pry, I'm not sure that it's an accident, comrade, that we're seeing these kinds of disturbances in the streets the United States, particularly at the hands of Maoists and other Marxists. But Peter, let me ask you about one other piece of this before we have to let you go. The grid is, of course, the key backbone of America's critical infrastructure. Without it, nothing else will work. Without it, as you and your colleagues on the EMP Threat Commission have pointed out, including its chairman, Dr. William Graham, most of us will be dead in a year without electricity. There's a concern that there may be other ways in which the Chinese gaining access to our grid, penetrating it, and potentially in a position to subvert it, even without going to the lengths of putting an electromagnetic pulse laydown over this country. And I'm thinking specifically of reports that the Chinese have now sold us transformers, which we are using in the grid. I'm sure there are chips in it as well. We know that they've been using cyber warfare techniques to put themselves in a position to interfere with it. And not least, Peter Pry, this is unbelievable, but two of the major industry organizations, research organizations, what have you, the Electric Power Research Institute and the Edison Electric Institute have both, as I understand it, Chinese government sponsors as associates for their enterprises, which means access to and presumably an opportunity to influence what they are thinking and doing, particularly about grid vulnerability. Just give us quickly your assessment of all of that. It's very ominous, is it not?
Absolutely it is. This is just another example of our blindly trusting China over the course of many decades. You know, it's not the U.S. government that owns the grid or that buys the components for the grid. The 3,000 different utilities in the United States do that. And it has come as a revelation to a lot of us that they've actually been buying extra high voltage transformers from China, and maybe even more importantly, SCADA systems for China for many, many years, you know, which means that these Chinese technologies are being incorporated into our grid that could make us vulnerable to cyber warfare, as well as combined arms warfare, doing EMP and cyber together. And the also the U.S. government, the Department of Energy, for example, has a almost incestuously close working relationship with these organizations that you mentioned, EPRI, the Electric Power Research Institute, and the Edison Electric Institute, that most Americans assume are good old-fashioned lobbying organizations for American electric power industries, but that they basically represent America. But it turns out that their research budgets, 30 to 40% of their research budgets, come from China. And one of their officers actually received a medal from the Chinese Communist Party for some good service that was being performed in their behalf.
Peter Pry, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but there is so much more here to talk about. I commend you for your great work at the EMP Task Force on National and Homeland Security. Do check out Peter Pry's terrific paper on the EMP threat from China at, among other places, securethegrid.com. Peter Pry, thank you for your time today, as well as for your leadership on this and so many other national security issues. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we will speak with Kyle Scheidler of the Center for Security Policy about the Boogaloos. And no, it's not a dance. We're told by our government that it's a serious national security threat. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. And it's great to be able to say welcome back to a friend and colleague for quite a number of years now. His name is Kyle Scheidler. These days, he is the director and senior analyst for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism at our Center for Security Policy. He has been tracking with great diligence over, well, now better part of a decade than I know of, probably longer, the enemy within problem, notably but not exclusively with respect to jihadists in our midst, as we were talking about with Christine Douglas Williams at the top of the show, but also of late, others that are currently involved in, well, what I think of as revolutionary activity, and some of those who really aren't as well. So we're going to talk about all of that with Kyle. Kyle, it's so good to have you back. Welcome. Let's start with a really important piece that you wrote at American Greatness on the 30th of June, entitled "The Hubbub About the Boogaloo Is the Worst Kind of Fake News." What on earth is the Boogaloo? And how does it fit into this whole mix?
Well, it seems a little ridiculous, Frank, but the crux of the article is regarding a recent intelligence report produced by a fusion center for the Department of Homeland Security. And the report warned U.S. security officials and others to be on the lookout for what they called violent adherence to the Boogaloo ideology. Now, for those of you who are not up on the latest internet memes, the term Boogaloo is used by certain trolls on the internet to make reference to an expected second civil war. The joke is sort of Civil War II electric Boogaloo, which is a throwback to a 1984 breakdancing film that wasn't very good. But this is the kind of way that memes produce on the internet. But in any case, the Homeland Security Fusion Center warned that these Boogaloo adherents, known for wearing Hawaiian shirts and for displaying images of a cartoon frog named Pepe, would be present at the threats to topple monuments and be a risk to ongoing First Amendment protests.
So these are extremists, we're told, that are going to pose a right-wing sort of countervailing force to the Marxists that are much in evidence out in the streets these days?
Well, they are being blamed essentially for being all of the negative elements of the protests. The violence, the attacks on police are being sort of laid at the feet of these internet jokers, rather than, of course, being the responsibility of groups like Antifa. So this is sort of serving as further evidence, so to speak, of the allegations made by, for example, Keith Ellison, when he argued that all of the violence in Minneapolis was the fault of right wing extremists and not the innocent Marxist protesters.
So, Kyle Scheidler, this is not your first rodeo. You have been tracking this effort to lay off on so-called right-wing groups or organizations, some of them white supremacists, we're told, this phenomenon of violent extremism. And in the past, this has been mostly, it seemed, a means of sort of obscuring or giving a pass to Islamists, jihadists groups. Now it's seemingly that the Marxists are similarly benefiting from it. What do you make of all of this?
Well, as you know, Frank, when we first started looking at the policy of countering violent extremism, one of the concerns that we had was that it divorced the actual threat from an understanding of the ideology of that threat. And it used this blanket term extremism. And what that allows people who are politicizing intelligence to do is to, on the one hand, lower the perceived threat of things like jihadists or Marxist revolutionaries by saying they are merely extremists who are radicalized on the internet and they just have some bad ideas. And on the other hand, it allows them to essentially take people who just have some bad ideas and present them as a real, genuine, organized threat or movement. And so that is what we're seeing. It's sort of a leveling where real threats can be minimized and non-threats can be risen to the level of appearing to be terrifying threats to national security.
In your experience, what's motivating this seeming, not just misperception, but misleading of the American people about the sorts of challenges that we're facing from one or the other of these actual threats to our homeland?
Well, I think the evidence for what this is ultimately seen in that intelligence report that I mentioned to you, where they cited as part of their evidence for this so-called Boogaloo threat, a group called the Tech Transparency Project. Now, it turns out that that project is actually run by a group called the Campaign for Accountability, which is linked to the Barack Obama campaign's former chief opposition researcher and a number of other left-wing dirty tricksters of the political sort. So it's a politicization of intelligence is really the ultimate goal, and it's using sort of left-wing opposition research and ginning it up to the level of a national security threat, and then giving it the patina of an intelligence report so that it can be breathlessly repeated in the media. We have seen this exact thing before, right? This is the crux of the Russian collusion hoax. Taking a few badly reported media pieces and transforming them into some kind of national security threat, which can then be used to denigrate the president. And so you have this intelligence report citing this opposition research that blames the president, blames President Trump for inspiring and energizing this so-called Boogaloo movement. And so it's just another way that they get to blame President Trump for the very disorder that are being caused by, you know, radical leftists.
Yeah, it seems as though it's familiar from the playbook of the Islamists, too, and their fellow travelers or enablers, in particular in the Obama administration. You know, see no evil over here, look over there, folks. I was really struck, Kyle Scheidler, because the relatively new U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, which is a key position, as you know, Carl Racine is his name, recently appeared on television professing that these people in the streets of America these days are really just a bunch of lone wolves, and they're self-radicalized, and they may have self-identify with some of these groups, but there's no evident command and control behind them. This sounds to me not only eerily similar to some of the previous comments made about the Muslim Brotherhood and jihadist organizations of various stripes in this country, but it just sounds like it's malfeasance, Kyle, when you have somebody as a senior law enforcement officer in the United States evidently not just downplaying threats that are pretty obvious, I think, but seemingly misleading the American people about them as well.
A perfect example of that is when Racine claimed that there was no Antifa involved in any of these D.C. protests. At the same time, when one of the leaders of those protests who was arrested had been named in the Washington Post as a leader of Antifa. So it's really, you know, a perfect example of, you know, choosing not to see, as you said, see no evil, Frank, that we have seen again and again, where real and genuine threats are ignored for political purposes and non-threats or minor threats are blown out of all proportion.
It is, and it's disheartening, because if we're going to defeat this enemy, and we must, it starts as, well, Sun Tzu, the famous Chinese strategist of several millennia ago, pointed out, you can't defeat an enemy you do not know. Kyle Scheidler, you know the enemy very well. You follow him and report on his activities better than just about anybody I know. And we're so appreciative that you're doing it at the Center for Security Policy these days. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us again soon, as I hope the rest of you will do tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.